Thank you, Tom. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Way of Truth. My name is Kenny Chumley, preacher for the Gibson City Church of Christ, and it's a real pleasure to have you with us today as we continue our studies about the truth of Christianity. Before we get to that, I'll take just a couple of minutes here to tell you about the Church of Christ in Gibson. The building where we meet on Sundays is on the south side of town on Route 47. We are catty-corner to the northeast from the drive-in theater. And we'll meet at 9 o'clock, and at 9 o'clock we begin worship with Bible classes for all ages. Now, in the adult class, we're studying the Gospel of Luke. This morning we're finishing chapter 15, talking about the parable of the prodigal son. At 10 o'clock, we bring all of the classes together, and then we worship by singing and praying, reading Scripture, eating the Lord's Supper, followed by a sermon from the Bible. I'll be speaking this morning from James chapter 1, talking about how to get the most out of a sermon. At the conclusion of the sermon, we take a short break and reassemble for a second Bible study that lasts anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes. We're in the book of Leviticus right now. On Wednesdays at 7, we have a midweek study that lasts for an hour, and we have classes for all ages. The adult class on Wednesdays is studying from Revelation. And we invite you to come out for that. And we have a website, GibsonCityChurchOfChrist.com, that contains audios of our sermons, of our radio programs. Our Sunday bulletins are put up there. And you can access that again by going to GibsonCityChurchOfChrist.com. The past few weeks, I've been talking about the criteria that are used to determine the veracity, the truthfulness of an ancient document. And there are various tests that have been devised by bibliographers and other scholars in this area to check the credibility of a document. When these tests have been applied to the Bible, no ancient document has gotten higher marks than Scripture. It cannot be faulted, it cannot be disproven, it cannot be shown to be a fraudulent writing in any respect. At the very least, the New Testament must be taken as reliable history, certainly as reliable, even more so than any of the historians that are recognized and studied in schools today: Herodotus, Thucydides, Homer, Julius Caesar, Pliny, Josephus. The New Testament has better accreditation for its veracity than do any of those historians. And so we have a book that is historically reliable. When we go to it, what does it tell us that forms the foundation, the basis for Christianity? To answer that, I want to refer you to an author by the name of Gary Habermas, who has done an enormous amount of study in this area. And a few years ago, he came out with a book entitled The Risen Jesus and Future Hope, in which he analyzed 1,400 scholars between the years 1975 and 2003. He analyzed 1,400 scholarly books that appeared during that time. And these books ran the spectrum from the ultra-liberal view of Christianity to the Bible Belt conservative view of Christianity. And Habermas analyzed the data concerning the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And what he discovered is, regardless of the theological underpinnings of the author of the book he was looking at, there were 12 things that they all agreed upon. Now, I want to go through these 12. Everybody agreed, number one, that Jesus died by Roman crucifixion. They all agreed that he was buried, most likely, in an empty tomb, a tomb that contained no other bodies. Number three, they all agreed that when this happened, the disciples were discouraged, they lost hope, they scattered somewhat. Number four, not long after the internment of Christ's body, not long after the burial, the tomb in which he was buried was found empty. They all agree about that. number 5. They all agreed that the disciples had experiences which they believed were encounters with the living Jesus. I'll come back to this in just a minute, but they all agreed that the disciples believed they had encounters with the living Jesus. Number 6, due to these encounters that they thought they had, due to these experiences, the disciples' lives were radically transfigured. Number 7, shortly after this transformation of their life occurred, they began publicly proclaiming the resurrection of Jesus. And number 8, they proclaimed the resurrection of Jesus in Jerusalem, the very city where Christ was crucified and had been buried just a few weeks before. Number 9, the central message that these disciples spoke about when they went out was the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. Number 10, they all agreed that Sunday became the primary day for disciples gathering and worshiping Jesus. Number 11, they all agreed that James, the brother, the half-brother of Jesus, who had been a skeptic during Christ's lifetime, before Christ was put to death, in other words, James didn't believe his messianic claims and pretensions, that James became a believer, believing that his brother Jesus was in fact the Christ, the Son of God. And then number 12, they all agree that years later, years down the road, the arch enemy of Christianity, Saul of Tarsus, became a believer. Now they all agree upon that. And there are some conclusions that can be drawn from these areas of agreement, areas of commonality, the first of which is that the New Testament story, the gospel story, is not legend. It takes generations for legends to hatch, for them to be told and retold and changed, and moreover, everybody knows they're legends. They know they're not talking about actual historical facts. Well, the story of Jesus was told within two generations of the lifetime of Jesus. I mean, every essential of the story was told within two generations. The story was told during a time in which people who were alive when Jesus was alive, who had seen him, who knew him, could be questioned, could be interrogated, so to speak, and could be asked about these stories and provide verification. You know, you've all heard the legend of Achilles being dipped in the river by his mother. And dipping him in the river, according to the story, made him invulnerable. But the problem was she held him by the ankle and didn't get his ankle all the way in. And it was when an arrow struck him in the ankle there at the siege of Troy that that's what killed him. Well, that story, had it been told while Achilles' mother was still alive, if in fact Achilles was even an historical figure, someone could have talked to his mother about that and asked, did this really happen? Is this the way it happened? And she could have explained what happened. You know, stories get started that have no basis in reality, no bearing to the truth. But the story of Jesus was told very shortly after he was on earth, and there were many people who could verify many of the details of the story. The story was not a lie. There were too many details that were told that could have been checked out and confirmed, especially by the enemies of Jesus in connection with his death and burial. And the people who told the story of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection, they were persecuted for that. You know, when the devil can't shut you up through argument, very often what he resorts to is assault. And that's what happened to the apostles. When they could not be refuted by the Jews, when they could not be argued away by any of the enemies of Christ, the devil resorted to persecution. And despite the fact that some of them were killed, they were beaten, they were locked up, They were tortured. Despite all of that, none of them, none of the apostles ever recanted his testimony. So if the story of Jesus, his death, burial, and resurrection is not legend, if it's not a lie, what is it? Well, the only out that the critics leave themselves at this point, they have to admit, no, this doesn't have any legendary features about it. They have to admit that there's no evidence that the apostles were lying. The only out that they leave them, leave themselves, is that the apostles, the New Testament writers, were deceived. They were tricked in some way. They were wrong about what they thought they saw. They saw something, but they were simply wrong about it. They were wrong in thinking that they saw Jesus alive after he was dead. They thought they did, but they were deceived somehow in that regard. And so when you ask these skeptics, well, exactly how were the apostles deceived? There have been a variety of answers that have historically been given that question. I'm going to talk about four of them. I'll try to get through the first three today. I'll save the fourth till next week, since the fourth is the one that's actually given in Scripture as the explanation for the message of the apostles. But the first explanation I'll mention is what's known as the hallucination theory, that the apostles hallucinated. They thought they saw Jesus, but it was nothing but an hallucination. It was like a mirage. You know the problem with the hallucination theory? There are two problems, the first of which is hallucinations are individual phenomenon. They are not a group phenomenon. No one has ever said to a friend, "That was some scary dream we had last night, wasn't it?" You don't say that to people because they didn't have your dream. You had a dream, but they didn't have it. That's the way dreams are. They are individual. Hallucinations are the same way. Now, there can be various reasons why a person might hallucinate. I remember before my grandfather died many years ago, I was sitting with him one night, and he got alarmed. He was sort of in a panic. He thought there were men in black suits circling around his chair. He could see them. I couldn't see them, but he said he could see them. He was a very sick man, dying of cancer at that time. That's the way hallucinations are. They are individual phenomena. And yet we have 12 apostles. We have over 500 people on one occasion. We have Christ being seen on separate occasions in a variety of settings. Men and women saw him. They saw him walking, talking, eating. They saw him over a 40-day period. No, hallucinations don't explain the reports of the risen Christ. Well, there are some who say that the apostles went to the wrong tomb. They went to an empty tomb thinking they were going to Christ's tomb. The tomb they went to was empty, and so they went out telling everybody that it was empty because Jesus had been raised from the dead. Well, let's assume for a minute that the disciples went to the wrong tomb. Did the Jews or Romans, the enemies of Christ, go to the wrong tomb also? No, they knew where the right tomb was. Joseph of Arimathea knew where his tomb was in which he had buried Jesus. The women took special note, the Gospels tell us, of where Christ was buried. They went back to the right tomb. And the fact of the matter is that the report of the empty tomb was not enough to convince the disciples that Jesus had been raised. What convinced them was when they saw Jesus. They knew the tomb was empty before they ever believed Jesus was raised. It was when they saw him that they became convinced that he was raised. Now, there are two others. Now, I've run out of time, but there are two others we'll talk about next week. The swoon theory, which is a very ancient theory to explain the resurrection, and the stolen body theory found in Matthew 28, the very first explanation given to explain the empty tomb. It was the one concocted by Christ's enemies, the chief priest. I'll talk about them, Lord willing, next week. I hope you have a good week. I hope you're enjoying this time of year when families and friends get together. And I look forward to seeing you next Sunday at 8 o'clock right here on The Way of Truth.